Hailing frequencies open, and welcome to Enterprising Individuals, the Star Trek discussion podcast that boldly goes into excruciating detail about the series, characters, and stories of the Star Trek universe. I'm your host, Aaron Coker, a.k.a. Caliban, and I'm glad that the franchise of Trek has always been willing to ask the big questions, like, is it feminist to have sex with your grandmother's candle ghost lover? I'm joined in this episode once again by New York Times and USA Today bestselling author Catherine M. Valenti. Catherine is the Hugo and Locus Award-winning author of over two dozen novels, short stories, and novellas, and many other works of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, including her novels Deathless, Space Opera, and her Fairyland series. Catherine has two new books due out in the latter half of 2021, The Past is Red and Comfort Me with Apples. Catherine, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
It's great to have you back aboard. And today we'll be talking about Sub Rosa, the 14th episode of the 7th season of Star Trek The Next Generation. Sub Rosa! The very utterance of the words is enough to send shivers down the spines of some Trek fans, and not for the reasons probably intended by the episode's writers. The mission of the crew of Star Trek in whatever era is to explore and to experiment, and the writers of Trek have a similar mandate to take a franchise that's about the quotidian lives of space travelers and use it to explore the human condition through the lenses of alien cultures and philosophies, often achieved through inventive genre bending and classical illusion. Just be ready for your personal mileage to vary. They said I could be anything, so I became a gothic romance with a haunted candle set on planet Scotland. But we'll talk about that a little later in the show. First, Catherine, it's great to have you back on the program. We last spoke in August of 2020 when there was a lot going on in the world, a lot of tension, a lot of plates spinning. Now it's June of 2021, and circumstances have once again changed. COVID numbers are down, vaccinations are up, things are starting to reopen. Is your own life starting to resemble normalcy?
I mean, I think that the question we all kind of will be asking ourselves for a while is what's normal?
What's next?
You know, like I feel like we kind of forgot. And then, I mean, those of us with, I don't know, a head on our shoulders kind of realized early on that normal might never come back. And it might never. My life, I work at home, man. I've worked at home before this happened. I worked at home while this happened. It is definitely different when it's not a choice. So like things are sort of moving back towards something like what I would expect. But like I also have a 2-year-old who can't be vaccinated yet. So we still have to take a lot of precautions and think through everything we decide to go to or do, because we still have this very vulnerable little person in our house. Even though the chances are very low, you still don't want to be the one who rolled those dice. But I might even be having an in-person masked and distanced reading for The Past is Red in July. So that's terrifying and exciting. I mean, the thing is, vast portions of the world are nowhere near even approaching the beginning of normalcy, and we're very lucky that November went the way it did, and therefore we've done a really good job with vaccinations, less of a good job with literally everything else, it's still very dicey and dodgy for a lot of the planet. And as someone married to an Australian, I'm well aware of how slow the process can be in other countries, particularly Australia, which is closed at the moment. It's an odd time. It certainly feels less end of the worldy than August 2020 did. But there's still a whole lot going on everywhere. Remember like 6 months ago when people tried to take over the government, ran into capital, that happened.
Oh, that was this year.
That was it was the first week of 2021, Bean Dad and the insurrection.
Bean.
So it's at least starting to feel like there is a possibility that a future will come that feels more normal.
Yeah, there's got to be a morning after. There just has to. It's so weird to become an adult and be living through times like this. And, you know, I'm not that old, but I was young at a time when people were going through similar circumstances. And I'm not saying that like our problems don't matter and that everything will work out if we just let it be. But people, you know, like us have survived circumstances similar to this and things did turn out okay. And so I don't know where I rank on the optimist or the pessimist scale, but I do think that, that, you know, that there will be a morning after and that we are on a long arc, but the long arc is heading towards hopefully justice and just peace for everybody. But you know, that might require some action from us along the way.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I do think that it's a little bit different in that a lot of the other events that you and I would think about, I think we're similar age, not the same age,
but
I think a lot of the events you and I would think about as generational events where like everything changed. So we're talking about 9/11, talking about Columbine, talk about Challenger, Chernobyl, you know, fall of the Soviet Union, all these kinds of things. Barring the fall of the Soviet Union / Berlin Wall, those were single events that were done happening on the day. All of the ripple effects went on for ages and ages. And in some sense, we're still dealing with the fallout from Nixon's resignation in this country.
Weirdly, yes.
But the thing itself was over by end of business, you know? And this wasn't. And I feel like that is a massive change that we're all going to be processing for a really long time. We all need therapy. 8 billion people, we all need therapy. And I don't think we're going to get it. So we're going to be processing for a while. But I think one of the things that we're going to be processing is that this was nothing like we thought a pandemic or, you know, an end of the world scenario would be. It was the introvert's apocalypse. It was very strange, but it just kept happening. And in some ways, we are not prepared for things that are not over and ready to be processed reasonably quickly. That's even how the war in Iraq was sold to us, that it would be in and out and quick. Like the quickness of news has been a defining feature for most of the time you and I have been alive. And this wasn't quick, and a whole lot of other crap happened in and among it, and it just didn't stop, and it still hasn't stopped. And I think that that is one of the things that is just going to be really hard to get our heads around, that this didn't resolve. It's still not resolved. It's going to be resolving for years and years and years. And, you know, all of us probably know someone who will still get COVID at some point, even if we and our families are vaccinated. And then, you know, as a science fiction writer, I think what I and my colleagues learned is that people suck so much more than we thought. And we were very pessimistic on that topic. Nobody would accuse 21st century science fiction of being like too optimistic. And yet like humanity found new ways to be totally trash. And you know, a lot of that was American humanity, but it is not just us. And it just unreal. All of the people who thought the hiding your zombie bite thing was unrealistic.
It's apparently so
it was
depressing.
Unrealistic in that it was, that's too mild. Like it's not active enough, just hiding it. So I think that post-apocalyptic fiction will never be the same. And I say that as somebody who's writing the sequel to Space Opera right now and dealing with a universe changing event and having to face what I learned about how humanity processes trauma, when the answer is very poorly and mostly avoidant. It will be both funny and tragic to spend the rest of our lives, and this is what's going to happen, talking about this. Sorry, I gotta, before we even start talking about the episode, I need to make super clear the swearing policy on this podcast.
Oh, yeah, you don't have to limit yourself.
Talk about fucking McFuckghost, I want to be able to use
yes.
my full breadth of language.
Yes.
Right.
We'll explore the entire ghost fucking genre. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. We're going to be talking about this for the rest of our lives. And when people who don't remember it are old enough to buy us drinks, we will be drinking on this for the rest of our lives. And talking about how, oh, you know, we didn't realize how it would affect everything. Well, it will affect everything. Realize it.
Yeah, it's so shocking and depressing to realize that, you know, 50% of the people in the world would not only hide the zombie bite, but tear the phone books off of everybody else's forearms to expose everyone. So, yeah, thought it was going to be like 1 in 6, 1 in 7. Turns out it's 1 in 2.
Yeah.
But let's move on to something more happy and uplifting. I feel like if we're going to talk every year, I need to keep asking you about Eurovision, get some updates. What'd you think about this year's winner, Måneskin?
Oh my God, I'm obsessed. So this was an incredible year of Eurovision. Like, if you're only going to watch one year, I got to tell you, if you're American, Peacock has it for free. It has never been easier to watch Eurovision. And this was a great year. It's kind of got everything that you want out of a Eurovision and some truly great songs, some of them very serious, many of them not, because we missed a year. There was no sense of trying to like copy the previous winner. So right. It was just all over the map as far as genre and style and content. It was very kind of nerve-wracking because a lot of people got COVID there, including some of the performers. So Iceland's, you know, wonderful singers that we've all come to love over the last 2 years didn't actually get to perform on the Eurovision stage live at all, which is really shitty for them. But I think they'll be okay. They're going to be Eurovision's house band for the next 50 years. So,
oh, that's fine.
the previous winner, the 2019 winner, also got it. So he didn't get to, like, you know, take part the way the previous winner usually does. So it was all kind of nerve-wracking. And then I'm not going to get too in the weeds about how Eurovision works, but there's 2 semifinals and then a grand final. The semifinals carve off 6 countries each, so that you end up with 26 in the final. Though that extra 6 comes from what are called the Big 5 countries. Those are the people who pay for it, and that's France, the UK, Germany, Spain, and Italy, and then the host country, which automatically goes through the final. So the reason I'm saying all that is because Italy won this year. Now, no Big 5 country has won since the last time, or since 1997. That's the last time. So it's not actually an advantage. And the reason it's not an advantage is that nobody gets hyped in the same way, because you're watching the semifinals and you have favorites and you're like hoping for people to get through, but you don't see any of the Big 5 countries at the semifinals. So people often come in with like predetermined favorites before they ever even see those acts. Italy has been very good for a long time. I usually don't watch anything before the semifinals start, but my editor for Space Opera DM'd me and said, you have to watch Italy. It's the closest thing I think we'll ever get to Decibel Jones and the Absolute Zeros actually playing Eurovision.
Nice.
And it is. It's glam rock. It's Italian glam rock. Yeah. It's boys and girls clothes and 8-inch platforms and the best eyeliner you've ever seen. It's just these young people who like got together in high school to make a band, and they are so earnest and lovely and wonderful, and I'm totally obsessed with their music. They're fantastic. They have, other than in America, because, you know, we're trash, they have charted all over the world with some of their older songs, not even necessarily the one that won.
Yeah.
But I think that other than like, it was very exciting for me that like this thing that is just right out of my book was happening in front of me. And I was getting all of these messages on Twitter going like, Des wins. And I'm like, I'm already really emotional about all this. So like, you don't have to make it more than it is. But on top of that, the song that they won with is called Zitti e Buoni, which means be silent and behave. And it's very much a scream into the void kind of song. And I feel like it's so captured where we're all at. And for me, where I really lost it and like the tears absolutely just flowed was there. Damiano's the main singer, the lead singer, and his acceptance speech. He went up on the stage, and you got to think that Italy is the first country that was hit in Europe by COVID really hard, and they have suffered so much. And this beautiful young man just took the microphone and said, we want to tell Europe, we want to tell the world, rock and roll never dies.
Yeah.
And because so many people did die, it just killed me.
Yeah.
And he didn't say it quietly like me, he roared it into the microphone. It was awesome. And it felt like rock and roll was this real homegrown DIY thing again. And boy, that is not what you ever get from Eurovision. Like, the Eurovision is a very packaged thing. That's what it's supposed to be. And this wasn't that. And it was a truly, truly special year.
That's great.
Yeah, so I will stop it there because I can talk about Eurovision approximately forever. But
well, speaking of being packaged, what do you think about the upcoming American adaptation of Eurovision, the American Song Contest?
I mean, first of all, call me when they actually do it. For people who are not like Eurovision mega fans, they've been promising Asia Vision for like 15 years, and they say this is the year, it's happening this year, and then nothing happens. So yeah. When it's actually happening and they say it's gonna happen this year, like states aren't doing, you know, selection processes. It's very weird. Like nothing's happening we're halfway through the year. I don't think it's happening this year.
Yeah.
But you know, it's also, you know, NBC Universal, which owns the rights to space opera. So I'm all for them doing it.
Sure.
But I will say that throwing a Eurovision and only inviting itself is the most American thing I can't even think of. It shouldn't be the States. It should be all of our hemisphere. It should be all the South American countries, the Central American countries, Canada. Like that would be great. There's not enough cultural difference between the States. There is huge cultural difference, but musically, because of Clear Channel and all the things that have happened with, you know, marquee level pop music over the last many, many years, musically there's country and there's alternative and then there's hip hop and there's everything else. And you can find that in every single state. So there's not, to me, in quite enough difference, and I don't necessarily want to see every red state throw up like the straightest cowboy they can find. whereas if we're talking about like Uruguay versus Mexico versus Chile versus Canada, I'm all in. Like,
yeah.
And the you would get the same kind of alliances and stuff that would be really interesting. Because, you know, the South American countries don't necessarily get along too well. So like you wouldn't necessarily have voting blocks. So if it was going to be an America vision, it should be an America's vision. I just think doing it with 50 states is ridiculous. But that said, the whole point of Eurovision was to bring a divided Europe together. Do I think the magic can happen for us? No, but I don't necessarily think anyone in the 50s thought Europe was going to be able to get it together the way they have. So,
yeah,
who knows? I am dubious. I don't think America should get to participate in regular Eurovision unless, if and only if, the entire planet gets to.
Sure.
And I just think it would be so much more interesting to have all of the Americas participating.
Well, hopefully it'll happen, and who knows, maybe they can run some Space Oddity book trailers during the ad breaks.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your new novels. Your book, The Past is Red, comes out on July 20th, and it's already got good buzz. Award-winning author Ken Liu has called it the Candide of our expletive-deleted age. Is that accurate? Is it a picaresque buildings Roman that serves as an attack on the optimism of the Age of Enlightenment?
So it's so funny because we got that blurb, and like, of course, you couldn't be happier with a blurb.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, shit, it is Candide. Like, there's something, and it's almost impossible to believe I didn't think once about Candide writing this thing, because it's so Candide. And I love Candide. And it clearly is something that like just sat at the back of my head and like did its thing without informing my frontal lobe about it at all.
Sure.
Is it an attack on optimism? No. Is it kind of a it is using optimism as a lens and a defense, really, against sort of all of the feelings we have about climate change. It's a climate change dystopia, and it is definitely a picaresque buildings Roman, all of those things. And Tetley, who is the main character, I mean, she is what drives this thing. Like, this started out as a short story called The Future is Blue, which won the Sturgeon Award. And that was why I was asked to sort of do more there. And people, I mean, even if they can't remember the name of the story, they'll tell you Tetley. Like, she is the thing. She is the core of it. And it's because she lives in this nightmare landscape where there's the ice caps have melted and the seas have risen and there is nothing left. And she lives on the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which has been pulled together and by survivors and is now like a, you know, smallish continent where she lives. And she has done a very bad thing and is being punished by the whole of her society. And she will tell you she's the happiest girl in the world. And her optimism is terribly hard won. And it is the juxtaposition between that and the reality of her environment. And she's not delusional. It's just who she is. Yeah. And nothing, she's never experienced anything but this world. So she sees beauty in it the way we all do. You know, if you've known nothing else, the light from a broken Coke bottle is as beautiful as anything else could ever be. You know, Oscar yeah. the Grouch is one of their dominant gods, and well, he lives in an infinite trash can.
Right.
and she is devout, and she tries her best. And I think that actually in we're talking about optimism in science fiction, I think that in the landscape of science fiction right now, that kind of optimism is pretty radical. And yeah. we're starting to see a trend towards these kinds of Alexandra Roland calls it hope punk, these kinds of stories.
Okay, sure.
That don't shy away from you know, horror and terrible things happening, but
yeah.
have a core of joy to them. And that's definitely what this is. Like there is some real shit that happens, but through all of it, Tetley is trying to hold on to who she is and trying to hold on to the world of herself. You know, she draws the comparison a lot between you know, the way she used to be when she was happy and the way the world used to be when there was land. Hmm. And it's a emotionally complex kind of situation. And I don't want to give anything away about the plot because there's some pretty cool twists. I was kind of realizing the other day that these two books, Pastures Red and Come For Me With Apples, have like the wildest twists I think of anything I've ever written, barring maybe the first Fairyland book. But I think these are actually more shocking. And wow. They come out within 3 months of each other.
Yeah.
So it's I'm really proud of it. I'm genuinely very, very proud of it as a book.
That's great.
And I haven't written about I wouldn't have written it at all if Jonathan Strawn, is a wonderful editor, hadn't invited me to be part of this climate change anthology. And thus Tetley came from that.
There's so many, it just seems like there's a rise in dystopic fiction these days.
Yeah.
And it's so easy for a dystopia story to become totally depressing. And I think forget that, like, you know, dystopia is about ideas and not setting necessarily. And I'm still kind of waiting for Star Trek to answer that question. Like I've talked before, yeah. I think we've talked before about Trek's kind of slide into apocalypse and cynicism.
It's just going
around. It's not unique to Trek, but I'm wondering if Trek will ever get around to letting its setting take a few more kicks.
Yeah, I mean, we have so much new Trek coming out in the next couple
yeah.
of years.
Oh,
I would hope that there's room, you know.
Oh yeah.
I'm a little discouraged by how similar Picard and Discovery are, but the ones that we've got coming out, you know, with the Pike series and Section 31 and all that, like those provide for some very different stories to be told, and I hope that they take advantage of that.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Let's talk about Come For Me With Apples, which comes out on October 26th. Other than the biblical allusion of the title, the plot seems mysterious. Would you classify the novel as...
very mysterious.
Would you classify it as being somewhat gothic?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. So the Come For Me With Apples is such a strange marketing situation. We knew it would be as soon as we sort of came around to publishing it as a book, because this is actually like the story of how this became a book is insane. I turned it in as a short story to Tor.com right before lockdown happened. Was it a short story? It was not. It was quite long. And like my submission email says, look, I'm really sorry. It got out of hand. I recognize that it is a polite cough away from being a novella. but like, I'm really proud of this work, and I think that it bears the weight of its length. And Jonathan Strong was my editor for that one as well, and he agreed. And I didn't hear anything for a month or two, and then I got an email saying that they had decided that it was too good for just be published online, and they wanted to make it a book. So it was their decision to make this into a novel or into a book. It never had to be. But what that meant was that I got to go just put like 4,000 more words in it that I wanted to, but I was holding back because I thought that I should probably not just give them this huge chunk of writing.
Yeah.
and sort of make it what it wanted to be. And then once we started talking about it, we were like, marketing is going to be so hard because we cannot tell anyone what this book is about.
Okay. Yeah.
Because what the book is about is like the premise is the twist. So it is my first book set in the suburbs. I've never written a book set in the suburbs before. It's my first murder thriller. So if people are interested in crime, true crime, serial killers, any of that kind of genre, like this is their one. I don't know if I'll write another one. This is definitely it. It's about a woman named Sophia who is a perfect housewife living in a very oppressive homeowners association cul-de-sac, and the homeowners association is kind of one of the dominant villains, it is about, most books are about a journey toward either understanding that your world is fucked or understanding that your world is not as bad as you thought, and this is definitely the former. So it's sort of about her coming to understand what the lie that her marriage was based on, and she as she finds a human fingertip in her kitchen.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yeah, and so she has to sort of, without letting her husband know that she is investigating this, figure out why the hell there's human bones in her house.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is October is a great month for it.
It is
very tense, very scary. Everyone who's read it so far has said they couldn't put it down, which is obviously the compliment that a writer wants, but
yeah,
my favorite one of those reviews is not one that we can put in the front matter, but a friend of mine's 15-year-old daughter grabbed it and texted me saying, oh my god, I could not put this down. And I feel like for an adult book for a 15-year-old to say they couldn't put it down, this can be a failure of a book and I'll still feel like I won. Yeah. You know, a disaffected youth loved it. So it's I think it's a very lean, very tight piece of very angry and scary work, and it's probably like the truest horror book I've written.
That's fascinating.
I mean, everything of mine has some aspect of darkness or horror in it. I'm a horror fan from way back, but like this it just sits very comfortably in the sort of mystery horror thriller genre.
That sounds great. And you know, compared to your other works, it seems like a very simple kind of plain premise. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just as you were talking about it, I started to get chills.
Yeah,
people will definitely react well to that, or get scared by it.
Yeah.
Why did you choose this specific episode, Sub Rosa, to discuss?
Because it sucks. So I want to say, much as I did the first time that we talked about an episode that wasn't very good, that everything I'm about to say is said with nothing but love. I love Star Trek The Next Generation. It is a show of my heart. It is my warm milk bath. I have watched every episode of the show more times than I care to acknowledge. It is a huge part of my life, my psyche. I've been watching it since it aired on television and I was a tiny child. I love this show. I love every character in it. Most of them. every recurring character in it. So everything I'm about to say about how much this episode is terrible is said with the joy of finding a terrible episode in season 7, which is otherwise an incredibly good season.
Oh yeah.
Actually, the fact that this is in season 7 kind of makes it worse.
We've all heard the jokes or made them about this episode. And, you know, you were talking about season 7. I think it's tough for a series to 1 week be talking about refugees and their rights or like military espionage. And the next you're reading a particularly erotic passage in your Nana's journal.
Yeah.
But Trek's no stranger Trek is no stranger to messing with genre, and you know, let's face it. As far as like, you know, being Star Trek, Mick Fleetwood played a fishman on this show, so maybe people can give it a little bit of slack.
Yeah, look, I think that this is an interesting episode because I think that for a lot of people, this is not the worst episode of Next Gen. not even it's not even really close. It might come in at 9 or 10, but I think that when you ask a random fan what the worst episode is, this does come to mind because it is so memorable in its badness. You know, some of the ones that are truly bad are they just fall apart and you kind of forget. Shades of Grey is the one that is like consistently ranked as the worst one. I barely remember that episode. It was so inconsequential and like, it's like a clip show essentially.
Yeah. That's what it is. Yeah.
So like, I think that the offense of deliberately crafting a story that is so bad is fundamentally different than having a crappy narrative structure for your clip show. So I find this episode fascinating in that it is so bad, but I don't think it is a failure. I think it sets out to achieve a certain set of things and achieves all those things. I just don't think those things are worth achieving, but that's fine. I think it does what it sets out to do.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to do it because it is the episode that everyone snickers about. And yes. I thought that like doing it, you know, you and I get into it on these episodes. I thought it would be fun to get into this one.
Well, I'll have to throw away all the nice things that I forced myself to write about this.
There are some, I do think that there are some positive things to say. My headcanon is 100% that somebody came into that writer's room and was like, I just read the most amazing book called Outlander. And like, we got to do it.
Well, funnily enough, I do have the story, the background of it, and it's not too far off from what you're proposing here. This story certainly has a particular air about it, and you're a classics major, so you know that Trek has never meant an allusion or a quotation that it didn't like. It certainly borrowed liberally, not only from Victorian fiction and English lit, but from the storytelling techniques of the novel. And I love to bore my friends by pointing out that the main storytelling premise of Trek is that it's being communicated through a series of captain's logs. It's a series of recountings, like an epistolary novel, of an earlier era. Why do you think that this kind of story, gothic fiction or horror, often seems to bounce off of Trek?
I mean, I will tell you the first thing that popped into my head. You asked that question, and it's going to be a weird answer. I think the lighting is a big part of it.
Okay, yeah, TV lighting.
So like, it's still in that very 80s era of TV lighting where everything is as bright as the sun. Like the lighting, the way Star Trek is shot, it never seems to lend itself to those kinds of stories, even when they go down to a planet. You know, it's still the blinding light of logic is what illuminates Star Trek. Yes. And this is a supernatural story, and that is a big part of why it stands out to me, is that there's been some shit episodes of Star Trek, but like, this is just magic. They throw out a couple of science words, but they don't even really mean it. This is just straight up magic. And so that is always going to bounce off Star Trek a little bit. I think the structure of this particular episode also is so focused on Beverly that everyone else is kind of out in the cold, other than Troy. We'll get to that in a minute. So it ends up almost feeling like a bottle episode or a candle episode. and so it also feels very separate from the rest of the show. But I think that Star Trek can do very scary stories. You know, I don't think that's ever really been an issue. Like, you look at DS9, there's definitely things that'll raise your heart rate in there. And I don't think that that's necessarily an issue. But I think Next Gen specifically doesn't lend itself terribly well to that, because it is so it is the series, other than the original series, that really digs its heels into the "this is the utopian future" thing. It's not till the movies that we start even really getting into analyzing Starfleet or corruption or any of that stuff. Like, we get the brainworms thing with Starfleet, and then that's over in an episode.
Yeah, right.
So this is the optimistic utopian future, and that doesn't necessarily play terribly well with horror. Mm-hmm. It can, but I don't necessarily think that the early to mid 90s was a time when that was happening a lot. That wasn't really on trend. So it's just we all want to make our science fiction fancy, okay? Like there's none of us that don't. Like we all feel a little proud of ourselves if we can work a Jane Eyre reference in there or something. But this particular kind of like Hounds of the Baskerville sort of horror, it's just very hard to jive with that futuristic thing, which is why we end up on Planet Scotland 17th century style, right. And then they try to take it away, but it doesn't work. I think that Discovery wouldn't necessarily have any trouble. I mean, we all know what the lighting looks like on Discovery, but like I don't think Discovery would have any trouble doing a gothic horror episode if they wanted to. And some of the short treks have been that.
Yeah,
and maybe it's partly because that episodic nature of it, like if you have this true sort of existential Cthulhoid horror and then you're fine the next episode, even for 90s audiences who are used to episodic storytelling, that's a bit rough.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, there's always the trope of people being affected by something, their hair goes white or something, or they're haunted to the rest of their days by something. And of course, next week it's going to be Paul Sorvino's going to show up or something else is going to happen.
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's a trope of gothic fiction that so many of the stories and novels in that genre are being told in flashback by somebody who survived it.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of those tropes are difficult to juggle in the blinding light of the very, very clean halls of the Enterprise.
Yeah. Sometimes foggy, but yeah.
Yes.
Well, we're talking about the TNG episode Sub Rosa. It first was released on January 31st of 1994. The teleplay is by Brandon Braga. And, you know, he's Brandon Braga. I don't need to explain who he is. I will say his first writing credit for Trek was the fourth season TNG episode Reunion. And his last Trek credit out of two feature films and 109 episodes was These Are the Voyages, the Enterprise finale. The story is by Jeri Taylor, who also needs no introduction. She got her start with Trek on the fourth season of TNG, and she was EP and showrunner in the seventh season. She would go on to co-create Star Trek Voyager and serve as executive producer until the fourth season and showrunner for seasons 3 and 4, The Good Ones. Taylor based her story outline for the episode on material from writer Jenna F. Gallo, and I'm going to save that to talk about in a little bit, and it's going to be awesome. This episode was directed by Jonathan Frakes. Yep, it's Frakes. This was his eighth and last time directing TNG. He's directed 22 episodes of Trek in total and the feature films First Contact and Insurrection. The star date for this episode, we don't know, which is uncommon for TNG. This is only one of five TNG episodes to not feature a star date. The others were Symbiosis, First Contact, Tapestry, and Liaisons. Although the closed captions for Captain Picard's log entry near the end of the episode show the star date as 474882. And your assignment, Catherine, if you can, is to give us a 25-word synopsis of Sub Rosa.
Doctor goes to depressing Ren Faire, inherits ghost fucker from her grandmother, fucks ghost, fucks off from ghost.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I guess I should have, restricted a couple words there, but no, you still made it. You made it to 25. I was going to say, can you do this without saying candle or ghost? But I think that would be absolutely impossible. Here's some interesting facts from the memory banks about this episode. The title Sub Rosa comes from the Latin phrase translating to under the rose, meaning doing something secretly or confidentially. The rose was often associated with secrecy in antiquity. In Greek and Roman mythology, the god Cupid gave a rose to Harpocrates, the god of secrets, on behalf of Venus to keep her secrets. Roses were often carved on confessionals to signify that confessions would remain secret. Sub Rosa is one of 14 episodes of Trek with Latin terms or quotations as titles. And the story from this episode came from an initial pitch by writer Jenna F. Gallo. This is Gallo's only TV credit, something that was not uncommon for contributors to TNG. The open-door script submission policy in place at the time meant that anybody who got the okay could pitch their ideas to the production. But that wasn't enough for some fans. There were some who saw suspicious similarities between the plot of this episode and the plot of the Lives of the Mayfair Witches series from novelist Anne Rice. That series, set in the modern day, features a creature from 17th century Scotland that is obsessed with the women of a particular genetic legacy. And there's a character named Rowan in that story. This was enough for some fans to be convinced that Rice had written for the show under a pseudonym, to the point where the IMDb credit on the show was changed to point to Anne Rice. Enter Jenna F. Gallo. In a 2009 review on the IMDb page for Sub Rosa under the username Bakke2, title of review, Anne Rice had nothing to do with this episode, exclamation point. The review, and it had to be in the reviews because IMDb thankfully killed its forum with fire long ago. The reviewer says that they are Jenna F. Gallo and that neither herself, Jerry Taylor, or Brandon Braga had read Anne Rice prior to writing the episode, and that it's very irresponsible to edit IMDb on a fan hunch. She also says that she liked the on-screen Scottish planet, and it was what she envisioned when she pitched the story. And presumably the credit was corrected after this. It now reads Jenna F. Gallo again. Then, in 2012, I went kind of deep on this, the website The Agony Booth posted a recap and review of Sub Rosa, and in the comment section, a comment from user Bakke2 reads, "There is a Jenna F. Gallo, and I am she." It goes on to explain that she is not a WGA member and therefore would not receive an on-screen credit in the opening. She is credited, though, in the closing credits. She says that she submitted a script to Jerry Taylor, which was purchased but heavily rewritten by Braga and Taylor. The original script was set on a Scottish colony and featured Beverly, but the grandmother character would have been alive, and if the writer had had her way, she would be played by classic screen actress Dorothy McGuire. Good casting. She says that she was disappointed that the script was rewritten, but that she defends the episode, saying that many fans liked it. Interestingly, she also says that she came up with the idea for the Voyager episode Distant Origins, which is the dinosaur one. Taylor bought the idea and adapted it, but by that time, the production rules about crediting had been changed so that she received no on-screen credit for that episode. So there you go, the record set straight. Anne Rice has never written for Star Trek, but if she ever had, I'd imagine it would look something like Sub Rosa. According to Jerry Taylor in the book Star Trek The Next Generation Companion, the original pitch had the concept that there had been aliens throughout history on Earth who had possessed people, and they were responsible for much of what we called supernatural or paranormal events. And the writing staff wasn't crazy about the seemingly magical elements of the pitch or its overly romantic tone, but Taylor purchased the story with the idea that it could be rewritten and that the romantic elements would appeal to the female fan base. And in fact, the working title for the episode was Passions, no relation to the NBC daytime soap Passions, which arguably featured gothic elements itself. So that's the story behind that. I think that it's clear that Taylor and Braga were both fans of the 1961 film The Innocents, which was based on the William Archibald play of the same name, which itself in turn was based upon Henry James's 1898 novella, The Turn of the Screw. Which was itself adapted recently into The Haunting of Bly Manor on Netflix. And the characters of the caretaker Quint and Crusher's ancestor Jessel Howard are named for characters in the novella and in the film. So I think it's fascinating that, you know, TNG had this open door script policy. Theoretically, anybody could write a script. Anybody could submit an episode if they liked it enough. And this person was, I mean, you can't really find her online, but like presumably just a fan who said there should be a Scottish planet and there should be, Beverly should be in a romance. And so I'm going to write a script. And they bought the idea and said, thanks. And then they just said, well, hey, what if we do this gothic horror thing, and then turned it into, you know, what it is. And I feel a little bad for Jenna Gallo because, you know, she didn't intend to write like one of the worst reviewed Star Trek TNG episodes there is, but that's kind of the position that she finds herself in for her trouble.
Yeah, well, so I'll tell you, I have actually read the Mayfair Witches series.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Remember I said I'm a big horror fan from way back?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So Rowan's the girl.
Uh-huh.
Rowan is the Crusher character in the Mayfair thing. So, you know. Also, I've always hated the name given to our friend, Mr. Ghost.
Ronan.
Because, so first of all, Ronan with an A is an Irish name. Yeah. Now, we're going to start talking about cultural appropriation and the way that Star Trek deals with Celtic culture in a minute. But it's literally not even a Scottish name, but they don't spell it that way. They spell it like the Japanese rogue samurai. So it just literally couldn't be more that mid-90s roll-up of geek culture.
Yeah, right.
Like, it's just a Katamari ball of mid-90s con culture. And that's what I always took it as. I never even made the connection to Rowan because it's a completely different character. in those books. And I think, I mean, Outlander came out in 91, and I feel like maybe they protest so hard that it wasn't Anne Rice because it was definitely Outlander.
Okay, sure.
That's my theory.
That's their dodge. It's not this one romance. It's this other romance series. Don't tell anybody.
More different one. But oh my God. Like, where do you start with this episode? I have so many questions about Planet Scotland itself.
Me too. And I think the way that it was realized was really effective. I mean, you know, this is all, none of this is exterior. It's all interior on a set. And they know what they're doing at this point. It looks great. Yeah. But why Planet Scotland? Yeah. Why?
So, I mean, look, all right, fine. I accept the existence of Planet Scotland. We've had Planet Native American. We've had Planet whatever. Fine. So right. Bunch of Scottish people. I mean, maybe, or were, so I'll tell you again, my headcanon is that none of these people are Scottish. They're all Scottish Americans who decided to go do a LARP.
I guess.
Many Americans who are a little over invested in what 23andMe says.
the fact that Maturin, you know, the main guy he's an alien, which, you know, it's fine.
Yeah, like,
but
nobody.
He's just a Scottish weeb, I guess, that moved to this planet.
Ronan doesn't have a Scottish accent.
No, he totally doesn't.
There is so little that's Scottish about this place. But so, okay, fine. This is, you know, the medieval times version of Scotland. Like, it's right, a Scottish theme park, whatever. So that's why we have this sort of 17th century version of Scotland, which is pretty weird when you think about it. Because, I mean, why? Why would you want to live like that? Like, they do understand technology, so they're just Amishing it up and, like, choosing to only use it behind the filigree iron grating thing, it's absurd that they would want to live this way. Actual Scots would be like, oh, we have a weather controlling satellite. Can it not be Scottish weather? That comes up that they're trying to fix the weather satellite, but that just means that they chose gloaming and cold and nothing grows here accuracy or something. It's an absurd idea of how anyone would choose to live. And much like what's the Irish episode, up the
long ladder.
Yeah, I was like, up the downstairs staircase is a play. Long ladder. It's the same kind of Celtic twilight. Like, when people are talking about cultural appropriation, this is that, only it's exotic whites instead of, you know, other cultures. And it is baffling how disrespectful to Scottish culture, Irish culture, any of it. Just it's all just thrown in the blender and hit frappe. You have to ask. So Ronan's in control of a lot of this stuff. He is a great influence, which is why the others are trying to sort of get away from him. So you have to ask if maybe it's that 17th century Tre Scottish thing, and not the hot Coke scene in Edinburgh in the 90s or whatever. because Ronan wants it that way.
Right. You know? Yeah.
So that's the only way I can get my head around that.
I
would
think
that he would want them to have Scottish accents, though. or to be Scottish in any sense other than wearing some dubious kilts.
In the planning stages, before they, because this is a very old colony, one of the first, or I guess a very early Earth colony. So while they're just getting things together, he's some Howard woman is, you know, one of the original colonists. And they're like, so what do we make it all look like? And it's like, Scotland. No, listen to me. Hear me out. We're going to make it look like Scotland.
And also, nobody will complain about the weather and the, the available crops in Scotland more than Scottish people. And yet they want to set up this Highland thing where, what are you growing, man? Is the rest of the planet a lush jungle world where you can actually grow food that is not oats and or lamb's blood? Is it there's just so many, why would you choose to live like this? Why? Why are there so many of you who have made this choice? And all clearly aware of the weird ghost in the candle.
Yeah, and I love the fact that their weather equipment is old for the future. It's 100 years old, so that allows it to malfunction, and we get the requisite lightning and thunder and storms. You know, I was mentioned before that Trek is in a lot of ways a Victorian novel set in space. So obviously they would do this, you know, like I like your comment about, yeah, what about the Edinburgh Coke scene, you know, of the 70s and 80s. But obviously they would do this, you know. Trek characters certainly love reading classic books and playing the cello. But Trek's, it's also the military nerds. Fiction. Yeah.
I mean, like I say that as a nerd, as somebody who enjoys all of those Horatio Hornblower.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for cello, sure.
All of it. Like I say that with no judgment and all recognition of my own hashtag relatable interests. But they are all huge nerds. And yeah. You know, unlike something like Mass Effect, where you'll get like the Blasto movies, we don't get a sense of what 24th century pop culture is in any way at any point during Next Gen. There's a few half-hearted stabs at it in some of the other series, but not in Next Gen. Everyone is, you know, cosplaying whatever pre-technological dandy they can find.
I just don't know if that's a bug or a feature, or if it's just because they absorb all this stuff, if they're tired of their you know, lotus eating world of technology and they wish for something more simple, or if it's relegated just to the military figures that we see, because, you know, the whole show is basically a narrative in the tradition of British naval fiction. And I think that the show is like the show itself in a meta way is always tackling or employing these tropes of like English literature that are hanging around in Trek storytelling, you know, the things that you would find in a Victorian novel: class, issues of duty, you know, the march of progress, certainly utilitarianism, you know, with the idea of the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the one, and science versus spirituality. You see those. I feel like our Trek characters are reading novels about those, and then they're actually living that like life, whether they know that or not in the story. And as far as like class goes, or just like the ins and outs of a 17th or 16th century colony in the future, look at Ned. Look at poor Ned. Sure, he's the helpful, you know, colorful servant character you'd expect in a fiction like this, but does he have a home? Like, she offers to let him live in the cabin, and I assume that he does have a home, but he's, you know, in a society where anybody can have anything, anybody who is a servant type character has decided they want to play the role of a servant character in their life.
Yeah, well, I do kind of like the idea that it's just maybe like condescending Starfleet people. Like, I have a home, Beverly. What do you think?
Yeah, right. You can stay here. Yes.
Like, this is not what you think. But yeah. So I actually wrote an essay about all of the hornblower hobbies of the Star Trek people. It's called Cisco Says. And if you read that phrase, you can find it. It's in my essay collection, which is called Indistinguishable from Magic, but you can read it online right now, no waiting, at Charlie Strauss's blog.
Okay.
And it is about how, you know, the way things would actually be on the station of DS9 or Enterprise is much more like Twitter than it would be this beautiful, fancy, we all have classical hobbies kind of thing. You know, Jake would be a terrible blogger who is just, you know, constantly trying to get things to trend on whatever the internal server Twitter version on DS9 is. And I think that, you know, part of that is mid-90s science fiction not being able to conceptualize the internet as the thing it became. Obviously, the internet existed in the mid-90s.
Oh, yeah,
and Usenet had been around for a long time, but it is exponentially difficult for somebody in 1994 to imagine what the internet would be in 2015. And that kind of hole in the imagining makes it feel very strange to us. I don't need everyone to be holding a phone, like the fact is that there is no internet at all. And there isn't in Discovery either, and they don't even have that excuse. There is no internet the way we understand it in the Star Trek universe. There is kind of in the Babylon 5 universe. But because of that, everyone's hobbies just feel like old people hobbies.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's what your grandpa wants to do. He wants to get dressed up as Dixon and go do a noir mystery. I mean, I guess those are escape rooms, though, so.
Yeah, that's true. It's, but, you know, it, It's possible they got fed up with it and got rid of it. I mean, I suppose that's one explanation for it. But Trek does get freshened up every once in a while. And I've always said that I like it. I think as the older I get, I like how much of a period piece it feels like in the future. But like on Discovery now, like I like the fact that our characters are dorks and stuff. Discovery, everybody's cool on Discovery. They're like partying and playing like beer pong. And then in season three, they all get cell phones. So they're calling things up on their little communicators. And so it definitely gets updated as time progresses. But yeah, at this point, it's just they made a choice because the internet wasn't big, but it existed. They could have, like, I think, posited it, but I think they just drew the line and said, no, this is where we're going to stop for now.
I think they maybe didn't know how to communicate it with visual storytelling. Usenet is very boring to watch, like on television.
Yeah, that's true. Click, click.
but yeah, I mean, even Tilly on Discovery, who is supposed to be uncool, is uncool in a very cool way, if that makes sense, you know?
Yeah.
Cool. But these guys aren't cool. Nobody's cool. In fact, one of the things that I was excited to talk about is that I have often asked myself, and when talking to other people about this episode, if like, do we have a problem with this because it's a sort of approaching middle-aged woman sexuality thing? You know, because we're watching an older woman, you know, express herself sexually, blah, blah, blah.
Well, it might shock you. It might shock you, but it's possible that much of the negative reaction was sexist because I think the general consensus is that male fans did not like it, but female fans probably also didn't like it, but didn't like it for different reasons, or even liked just having like a romance story in Trek.
Well, I mean, I'll say a couple of things about the idea. One is that Gates McFadden has never looked better than she did in this episode.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Holy crap. She's gorgeous. And like they suddenly did her makeup in a different way. And she's got highlights in her hair. And she looks amazing. Like she has never looked more beautiful than she did in this episode. She looks gorgeous. Two, when I ask myself that question, is this sexism and misogyny that is making me feel uncomfortable at this episode? I just try to imagine Riker being the focus of this episode, and then I make every face David Rose made throughout the run of Schitt's Creek. Like, it makes me so much more uncomfortable to think of any of the male cast members being the taking her part in this plot than I do with Beverly in it. Like, the idea of like anyone walking in on Picard having a private moment with his grandmother's candle, like,
you know, knock in the future.
I think Picard is hot. Like, it just, no way. So I think it's maybe not so much that as the fact that it's just a very uncomfortable masturbation based storyline.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And there isn't. There isn't a ton of sex in Trek, not for lack of Gene's trying.
Next Gen is a very sexless kind of atmosphere, even though Riker bangs, he does.
Yeah.
But it's nothing but cringe.
Like, and but it's all cringe. Yeah, whenever they try to fit it in, it just doesn't fit, so to speak.
And almost all of Troy's, I hate to say this, and I started like really thinking about it in preparation for this episode, but like, I feel like it's conservative to say 80% of Troy's sexual encounters on the show are not consensual.
They're negative.
Like,
yeah,
and it's not good. So like it is a very sexless kind of professional atmosphere. You know, I'm not saying that I prefer Enterprise where everyone's literally just rubbing each other all the time. Like, no, everyone's at least like a professional.
That's an overcorrect.
Workplace.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. Except for Riker, who didn't get that memo. But It is probably the least sexy of the series. You know, Kirk's a lot sexier than anything that happens in Next Gen. You know, they knock out the Yar and Data thing really early on.
Yeah.
It's not the show for this. It feels very weird.
Yeah. It is. It's a weird shift. And I'm willing to put on the board. I'm willing to entertain the idea that, you know, just the predominantly male fans were uncomfortable seeing female pleasure depicted on screen. The recent Batman controversy comes to mind.
Heroes don't do that.
Well, I guess not.
But ghosts do.
Ghosts do. I'm no hero. I'm a Byronic character. I'm an anti-hero. Yeah. I love the fact that
I'm the world's roughest 34.
Yeah, he was 34, I guess. He really was 34, as far as I understand. I love the fact that this dark, brooding guy that holds this power over this woman and can turn into mist, you know, it's very Dracula-like. And then they go out and they actually cast Dracula as the guy. It's like really on the nose.
Yeah.
He played Zorro, too, in a Family Channel series, So talk about appropriation.
I only know that because my husband was like, I've seen that guy.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, okay, dude, like, I got a podcast in a couple hours. And he was like, no, but I've seen him. And he was like, it's Zorro. They played in Australia like every day.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sure. Sure.
So, yeah, no, I mean, Zorro, who very rarely gets played by anyone of Zorro's actual nationality.
yeah.
But like, speaking of that, so at no point, we're in season seven. Right. Yeah. At no point has Crusher ever mentioned that she's Scottish, ever. Has ever mentioned her grandmother or what an inspiration she was. Has mentioned that her maiden name is Howard. Like none of these things have ever come up, which is why when people are like, oh, you know, Michael Burnham, like was never mentioned as Spock's sister. I'm like, nobody ever talks about anything until it's necessary for the plot in Star Trek. Yeah, like we have like, all this stuff comes up about Crusher that we have never heard and it will never be mentioned again. Like,
oh yeah,
it just it is so strange to me that all of a sudden her Scottish heritage is so important to her and her grandmother is this like dominant figure in her life. But that didn't come up like in the episode where she was in the caves with Picard and they were like spilling their hearts out about how much they loved each other and like their psychic connection and everything didn't come up that like,
well, there's the psychic connection. No, but in the first season, there's an episode where they also fall in a hole and she uses, she talks about her grandmother was a healer and used herbs. And that's how she knows how to pick what herbs are on an alien planet.
Ew.
But I, for me, it's just like, you know, there's a lot of things that sort of sit in the hopper of ideas for a character. And I'm just imagining that like her Scottishness was still on the board in the corner, a dirty dog-eared, you know, note card that, you know, seventh season, we finally get down to like, what about Scottish? What can we do that?
But like, again, why are we still doing herbs? You know that they have magic medicine, free magic medicine. You don't need to be like digging up Angelica root and being a country witch unless you want to be. And why would you want to be? It sucked. Everyone died. Like, why? I mean, I know when you say grandmother, everyone like pictures the olden times, but in fact, this is the 24th century. And like Beverly's grandmother was born far after all of us. And I just like the way she says healer bothers me. Like, what are you talking about? Was she a medical professional, Beverly? It's so strange.
A healer. Yeah, I'm sure she got all of her meals from a replicator and everything else. Although in that one episode, Family, where Picard goes back to his ranch or whatever, his wife or his brother's wife is only making like natural meals. She doesn't want a replicator in the house. So there's
For food.
This Luddite movement like, or this.
Yeah. For food, and Sisko's dad does too. But I guarantee you, when one of them gets cancer, they're not going to go out and eat some grapes about it.
Right.
Like, they're going to go to the city.
I try that homemade chemotherapy.
Like everyone does.
Like mom used to make.
God.
Do you think that there could be a Trek soap or a Trek series that has a romantic adventure at heart?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that part of the reason that this episode and those like it don't age that well is I think that the tropes of romance literature have really evolved from then. So this doesn't necessarily, this feels like, well, for lack of a better term, what I have always called grandma porn. So many of us grew up with active grandmothers in our lives and were occasionally left to our own devices in those grandmothers' houses and pulled books off the shelves, books like Clan of the Cave Bear, that, you know, were ostensibly literature, but actually were pretty steamy stuff. And if you want to start a fun conversation with anyone of really any age, like ask them what they read from their grandmother's bookshelf, because the answers are always hilarious. And so this feels like an old romance book where you can't relate. You know?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Where we're like, oh, so that's, whoa, that's what like grandma thought was hot, being possessed by a ghost who's fucked all your relatives. That seems cool.
Yeah.
Like, But romance literature has really boomed in the last 15 years or so. And like, there are way wilder things than a candle out there. If you are not a reader of romance, but it has really evolved with the times and to be very inclusive and to have all kinds of tropes and ways of telling stories that feel relatable to more modern audiences. And this just doesn't. This is a story, if you just take out the starship part, this story is fine in 1910. And so that's part of the reason it feels a little weird too, because ostensibly, at least Next Gen is at least somewhat feminist in that women are allowed to have jobs.
As healers.
Yeah, as healers. That's it. But like, you know, at least they don't get paid because there's no money, but like,
right.
They have a rank, occasionally get to wear something other than a cat suit. And so it feels strange that Beverly doesn't, I think the fundamental problem with this episode is that nobody ever thinks this is as weird as it is. They think it's weird, but they are not getting it. They are not getting the level of weird this is. So Beverly like has these simpering little conversations with Troy and she's like, peace out, I quit, to Picard. Like, we never have Beverly being like, oh, I'm gonna leave my career for a man. Like, what could be a really interesting core of this episode with this sort of alien mind control warring with someone who has a very strong sense of self that is literally based in her job? Everything Crusher revolves around her job. And so the fact that we don't ever have a moment where she's like, oh, am I going to do this thing that is the previous generation's story of womanhood?
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of where you see where this falls in terms of feminist storytelling on television, because she never has that.
Yeah.
Not only does she never have that conversation, no one ever questions her on that topic.
The only thing I can think of that would be an update to the sort of story that it's trying to do, like a gothic romance or a horror story, is that there would be, she's under the thrall of the evil man, and somebody else would run in, the love interest or something would run in and save her, and she does save herself. I think that's the Trek's kind of concession.
I mean, Picard does run in like that, but he gets
that. Well, he tries to, but then he gets bitched out by Ronan, yeah. But, you know, at least they've got that going for them. But yeah, it is, she never really does question that. And that could have been like the whole middle of the show.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, even when Picard's like, well, I guess we have to respect her decision. Picard knows her better than anyone. He's not like, what the actual fuck?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, that's not her. Also, what's going on with this candle and planet bog farm, like nobody reacts to this as though it's weird when Crusher has that conversation with Troy. Oh my god, you quoted it earlier when she says, oh, I did fall asleep reading a particularly erotic passage in my Nana's journal. Okay, every word in that sentence is terrible. It's just awful. Like, let's rewind, erase that.
Troy doesn't judge.
And Troy doesn't judge, and of course she wouldn't. But at the same time, who does not throw the book across the room as soon as you realize you're reading Grandma's Bang book? Like, that is not normal, Beverly. Boundaries. Ew. Like, God. Oh, I mean, I adore my grandmother who has passed, and if I would absolutely read a journal of hers if it came into my possession, and the minute there was a sex anything in it, I would not skip ahead.
Right.
Nope.
Right.
And like, everyone just skates right over the incest vibes of this whole story. Just like, nobody even mentions, is it a little weird?
That you're doing your grandma's side piece.
Like, the side piece of all your grandmas. And the only reason it wasn't your mom is because of planets. Like,
planets got in the way.
Like, just because the long distance carrier couldn't like deal with the bandwidth, I guess. But like, it's very strange that no one's like, right. So you're masturbating to your grandmother's journals and you're super open about it. Like, just talking about it in 10 forward, like no one's gonna take that to Enterprise and be like, hashtag overheard in 10 forward.
I was Dan Aykroyd in that Ghostbusters scene last night. Star Trek is so weird about sex, and you know, we could talk all day about this, so maybe not too much, but if they're supposed to be, you know, enlightened about it. I mean, I could believe that two friends could talk about something like this. I can maybe believe that she could have latitude about, you know, learning more about her grandmother, but it never commits to it. And I don't know if it's because it's a family show or like nobody who writes this show has gotten laid. I mean, I know it's being written by nerds. I know it's being written by nerds, but you think
Braga got laid.
They could, well, I suppose, they could ask somebody. Maybe it's not possible for like a family show to be erotic, but there's plenty of shows in this genre like Farscape or the reboot of Battlestar.
Then don't use the word erotic.
Yeah, they don't know. Like, they say erotic, so for gross. Sure. Like, yeah. No. But other space shows can get it on, no problem.
Well, I mean, sure, but other shows set up really different dynamics and standards, and
yeah.
I mean, half of everybody's half naked in Farscape.
It's a well, that's true.
Australian BDSM scene, but like, it's a whole sort of different situation, and that it is Beverly who is very straight laced. I could buy this from Pulaski more than Crusher, actually, in some ways.
Oh, man. I want to see that so bad.
But Pulaski would be exactly like what we're talking about. She'd be like, hold up. I'm sorry. All of my grandmothers? What are we talking about? Like, she would ask all the questions that we're talking about. But what gets me is that even after all this is over, even after she knows everything about it, the last thing Crusher says about this is still the like, oh, well, I guess this was kind of spicy. She says, like, I was about to be initiated into a very unconventional relationship. No, that's not what this is.
Yeah.
At all. And
he was
like,
nice to Nana. He made her happy.
Say it's a family tradition. He made her happy. Nope. No, that would be space rape. And also, he possessed her. So he could make her feel anything she wanted. And like,
yeah.
Crusher just does not. She just blows right past all that and is just like, teehee, I guess I'm not going to date grandma's ex.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Strange. Like, nobody takes it psychologically seriously in any way. And one of the things I love about Next Gen is the way it kind of gracefully moves toward taking things seriously psychologically in that episodic kind of old school science fiction storytelling way with family and then with some of the other, even just within the episode, reactions to things like and Data and Yar herself, the character, and then the sort of versions of her that came afterwards, you know, deals with trauma, deals with that you're never the same when something terrible happens to you. And it mm-hmm. was really interesting to watch that sort of slow motion develop. And then this episode, Crusher's like, lol.
yeah. But like, okay. I love this format. Like, one of the things that frustrates me about newer shows is that just every show, no matter what it is, you know, a Kevin Hart show, a vampire show, they're all serialized. You know, they're all like novels or movies, long movies that are chopped up. And to be honest, that's probably, I don't know, it's a new frontier for TV, because when I think about Star Trek, I think about the hour show, you know, five acts.
Yep.
We just knock them all out and then we move on. And it's, you know, the medium might be the message as far as like these older Trek series go, where we've got to have standalone shows and nothing can really go from episode to episode. And so, yeah, obviously she's going to be like, well, that was a crazy adventure, and they're just going to move on.
Sure, but you could say that was a fucked up adventure.
You could, yeah, that's true.
Right?
You could say that.
Everybody thought that was messed up.
That was bad news. Like, but I guess I do like that in the newer shows that are serialized, we are getting actual relationships, mm-hmm, you know, like Michael and Tyler, or Hugh and Paul, or Michael and Book in Discovery. Yeah.
Well, and like, so they liked this so much, they essentially did it again with Janeway and her Irish village holodeck man.
Yeah.
apparently this like this sort of not really a Celtic dude thing was appealing to multiple versions of these writers' rooms. But like, even if Troy, in that one scene she has where it's just her and Picard, she could be like, all right, look, I mean, I will always support my friend and I'm a counselor, so I'm not going to be a dick about it, but like, this is bad. This is terrible and weird and gross. Like, are you grossed out, Jean-Luc? Because I'm super grossed out. Like, even that, I just want to see Troy make a face about what some of the things people tell her sometimes, but specifically this, because they talk about sex a lot, Crusher and Troy. I feel like it is you can't even say it's men writing, because, well, women had a lot to do with this episode, if not all of it.
Jerry Taylor was running the show at this point.
But
yeah.
It is as though people who have never met human women imagine what human women might talk about while they're doing their weird yoga workout in a karate outfit. And so, like, Troy and Crusher, when they talk, and it's just the two of them, almost exclusively talk about dating and sex. It is unsettling. But, like, I would have loved to see a little more depth to their friendship, because it isn't a session, you know?
Yeah, right.
It's not a therapy appointment. This is not like betterhelp.space.
Right.
So she could be like, hey,
girl.
She does say like, oh, are you sure? But she doesn't say,
No, yeah, she just makes Marge Simpson noises. Yeah. Well, Beverly runs off and does it. Yeah.
So I think that the episode could just be improved a lot by a little psychological realism. But of course, that was not really the trend then, you know?
Yeah.
So it's hard to judge that, because this is a Golden Girls episode in space. It's one of Sophia's stories. In space. And so it's hard to be like, well, you know, you should have had like people rolling their eyes at her and making the jerk off motion in the background. But like, that is what actually would have happened. They probably would do it on Discovery.
Ghost sex can't be that much of a weird thing in the 24th century. They have holodecks. So like, paraphilia is like a career in the future.
Sure. And like, if they had leaned a little more into the science than the Gothic, it might make a little bit more sense.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there isn't any more to minuet than there is to this ghost.
Yeah.
Except that this alien ghost thing is sentient and alive and has been at this for a while, which brings me to the thing that I had never thought about before rewatching it for this podcast. And I was like, wow, really? So at the very end of the episode, when she's talking about, you know, she's doing the exposition of what this all is, and like, you've been doing this to the women in my family for centuries, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, huh, centuries, huh? Okay, so let's just assume that by centuries, she means at least going back to the environment we see around us in planet Scotland. So 17th century, you know, what people think of when they think of Scotland, you know, Braveheart to Culloden. Then you got to accept that the only aliens who claim to have contacted Earth before that are the Plutonians from Plato's Stepchildren in the original series. And they never ever revealed that they weren't human, which means this guy, Space Fabio over here, there's an argument to be made that he is the first contact alien with Earth.
I suppose. I mean, there's Apollo, and there are the aliens from Assignment Earth, but I don't know what the specific years are on those. Doesn't Ronan say, maybe he's lying, but Ronan says that he was born in Scotland in the 17th century, right?
So I assumed that he's an alien, though. He's an anaphasic alien. So I assumed that was a total lie.
Yeah, I suppose.
And that somehow he thought ghost was more believable than alien, which doesn't make any sense.
And then there's like,
given that she has a starship, man.
And then there's Flint, who I don't know if he's just, because he just was just, just didn't die for some reason. I don't know if he is human or if he was an alien, but I mean, they're definitely in the top three aliens. Well,
and Apollo and all of them didn't reveal to anyone what they were, but the Howard women were at least aware that there is a hereditary sex ghost. And I have a hard time believing. I know we want to pretend that Nana Howard here is some kind of old timey healer, but in fact, she's a citizen of the 24th century.
Right.
He probably told her he was an alien too, because why would you not?
That's his day one pitch. He's just like, I'm an energy alien, great sex. Let's get this going.
Yeah. So depending on how we interpret centuries, it really is not depending on how we interpret centuries, actually, because there's a big gap. There's the Apollo and the Plato stepchildren thing, and then almost all the other like claims to have contacted Earth pre first contact day are 20th century or 19th century.
Yeah.
Almost all of them. Yeah. So he absolutely has to be top three. And I'm saying he's probably number two and probably the first one where humans were aware that he was not a regular dude. And that's very sad for planet Earth.
Yeah. Well,
so basically the OG boy.
Like, he's got a good sales pitch.
Managed to find Earth before almost anyone else.
Yeah. I should mention
Borg stand in shame.
Yeah, right. You guys don't have sex. I'd have be remiss if I didn't mention that this episode is, of course, the source of the popular Blazin' Bev meme, or the Beverly Kusher, because of the green smoke that is all throughout the episode. So yeah, he's got a good sales pitch. Good sex, good drugs.
That's how far they want to take the whole, like, it's the most Celtic story that ever, we even have to have some kind of fan theory about why she doesn't have green eyes instead of just making the magic color blue.
Yeah.
Like her eyes have always been. It has to be green because that wouldn't be as erotish as as this thing has decided it wants to be.
Well, of all the bad things we've said, I do want to commend Gates McFadden on her performance, because she's 100% she's 100% committed. And I want to maybe ding Jonathan Frakes a little bit for how he dealt with some of the scenes, you know. As we said, like, it's the episode looks good, it's lensed well, but the scenes where she's being affected by Ronan, or she's in the throes of passion, or is even jonesing for some ghost, I don't feel like the director protected her much as an actor. You know, it'd be tough for Meryl Streep to pull off some of the dialogue. I know it's not, you know, it's TV and it's not film, like you mentioned, the lighting is different, but as somebody who's acted on camera myself, you should do more than just a 3-minute take when you're showing a character doing a psychological distress or they're throwing themselves around a room. You have to do more than just like one setup.
They don't call him two takes Frakes for nothing.
That's true. He just, yeah, it was literally two. And they botched the sound on one.
No, I think that's a really salient point, actually. And it definitely, I think that's part of the cringe of it. Like part of the faces that one makes is that it does feel exploitative. In some scenes of her.
Okay, writhe. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you end up kind of feeling like you're in the position of the ghost, which is gross. Because like, you're watching this thing, which is very private and weird and upsetting to everyone involved except for Beverly. It's they kind of try to bring in this sort of subtext of addiction, which doesn't play quite right, though I think one of the nicest bits of acting in the episode is when Gates McFadden lights the candle and then like rubs her legs on the bed. Like it's just a nice little bit of physical indication of where she's at emotionally, and you know that her mind is already down on that cold planet and not in a climate controlled room, and that you know she probably has the shakes a little bit, but they never really go anywhere with that.
No, they don't.
Stick with the sex thing. And again, like, the way that we write television is just so different now. Because now, I don't think anyone would have an issue with her having a little monologue about, like, she's a human being who's been living on this starship where nobody's banged her for 7 years. Right. Like, and now someone's paying actual, you know, intimate, close attention, even if it weren't sexual, like, to her. To the exclusion of, you know, all the other people who are more often the center of the stories, and that attention is a powerful thing. And we would probably just say that straight out right in an episode now.
Yeah.
And it would be a cool monologue, but that's not really how it happened then. So you just sort of end up feeling that it feels like they couldn't decide whether it was drugs or sex, a metaphor for, you know?
Yeah, well, they didn't have time for scenes like that because Geordi and Data have to go figure out the thing.
Oh, God.
I did like, one of the things that I really liked about Francis Ford Coppola's film adaptation of Dracula was, I don't like it when they mess with books usually, but is adding that element, is adding the actual romance between the two of them, and how his attention to her as a, you know, Victorian soon-to-be housewife who is never going to get to experience all these things is a seduction for her. And seeing Bev actually question, like you said, question her, like her job and her commitment to Starfleet, instead of just being ghost roofied, would have had a lot more impact, I think.
Well, yeah. I mean, and so we end up talking about what this episode could have been in terms of what we want in television now. It obviously wasn't what people wanted in television then either. Yeah. But, you know, there is actually quite a lot of juicy stuff in this storyline. They just kind of chose not to pursue any of it. And, you know, some of that's probably cultural and some of that is the limitations of, you know, 42 minutes with commercial, although I think it was more than 42 minutes at that point, with commercials, storytelling, and just the confines of Star Trek when you're in that late stage of a franchise. Yeah. But you and I, just shooting the shit on a podcast, can easily think of a way that this is a very compelling episode.
Yeah.
And it just isn't. But it also isn't half as bad as some of the really egregious episodes. It at least is fun to throw your popcorn at it. You know, drink when you see the candle. Like, it is fun enough to make jokes about. And even like the title, like, you point out all the correct things about the title and what it means and all of that. But like, also, we know the rose and the petals and it's a vagina. It's that's also what's going on there.
I can't believe that they were thinking that. But you're right.
Oh, of course they were. Like, everyone, if you're going to have your one sexy sex episode,
they did name an episode
writhing by herself.
They did name an episode Menage a Troy. So maybe that's
the one episode where a woman is enjoying herself on her own after a rose. Okay, Georgia O'Keefe.
Okay, all right, you got me.
We get it. I got it. very clever. It's certainly, and it comes up just like right smack in the middle of the season too. It is a very strange placement for a very strange episode. But we all remember it, right? Like I couldn't remember what Shades of Grey was before going to look up the plot. But you say Sub Rosa to me, I'm like,
that one.
It's that one. Everyone remembers it, and it is iconic in its own way. It just comes off very strangely. And I think, you know, you mentioned the Byronic hero, and that's very true of what's going on in this story. And the Byronic hero, I think, aged fine, like right until it fell off a cliff, when women were like, don't actually want the like alcoholic who doesn't want to talk to me.
Yeah,
that seems less than fun. And this guy, like, he's Ronan is always grabbing her by the shoulders and threatening toward her and like looming over her. He's always like breathing fast. Again, maybe the coke scene from the 90s in Edinburgh is coming back on some level, but he's constantly like sweating and breathing fast and like urgent, and he never like sits down and like has a conversation where he's like, what are your interests and hobbies? Which I think would actually probably be quite seductive to Beverly, because everyone's just like, fix me. doesn't really engage with her on that level. And she has her stupid son around all the time to like get in the way of her game. But he is a weird and off-putting figure from the jump. And we never do get a moment where you're like, oh, okay, I kind of get it. Which is pretty, it's vital for stories like that, to have a moment where you almost get it.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I think that their instinct was to make sure that we knew that this obviously wasn't the guy. And I think that Byronic characters, Trek is bereft, I think, of a lot of Byronic characters, where I would expect there to be more. I don't know how much Horatio Hornblower was getting, but Kirk's got him beat. Like, Kirk has an element of the Byronic character, I think. But generally, there's not a lot of brooding, you know, happening on board the Enterprise. Maybe it's just a facet of their utopian universe or whatever, but whenever they try to throw a Han Solo type guy at Outrageous O'Connor or whatever, that guy's usually not, he's the figure that we're not supposed to follow, and they just sort of slide off the premise, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you could make an argument that Sisko has a lot of that in him. In that, you know, he's very, even his line readings are very dramatic. Like, everything he says is dramatic.
Oh, that part of it, for sure.
He's the chosen one. He does very amoral things.
that's true.
You know, he is at least ostensibly a good guy in a romantic relationship, but he's never a person you would fully trust.
Interesting.
And he's got that huge frame that like all the Byronic heroes have. You know,
yeah, that's
tall,
true. Yeah,
broad guy. Yeah. And it certainly gets more and more like that. But he's got the dead wife. as you start out. He's got, you know, the orphaned son, like the character of the orphaned son, who is not as big and strong and burly as all the other boys, is a staple of Gothic literature. So like, I actually think that I had not thought about that till now, but I think that there's definitely some goth man in Cisco.
Insofar as his series arc is him climbing out of that into becoming an inspiring figure, I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
Well, speaking about captains and space dads, your favorite captain is Picard, who obviously has a very tough job in this episode and does not know how to knock, but he does his best to try to confront this ghost.
He's so uncomfortable.
if another Trek captain found out that their erstwhile paramour was in the grips of a candle ghost, how do you think they would deal with it? Who would be the next best one to put it in this situation?
Oh my God. Well, so the first thing that popped in my head is just the look on Janeway's face when she marches in. Oh my God, my stomach hurts a little bit. That's funny. It's funny. And also, of course, it's which Janeway is it? If it's you know, Catherine, the airlock Janeway.
Yeah, right. Phaser out. Like,
right. See ya. If this is your thing, we're out.
Shoot the candle.
But yeah, I think that probably a lot of the other captains wouldn't have taken quite as personal an interest in that you've got that relationship between Picard and Crusher.
Yeah.
Very pre-established. So it makes sense in that way. I think a lot of them would probably just shoot it.
Yeah, like, probably.
Kirk shoots it, no questions asked. Like, you know, clean it up afterwards. Scotty is probably deeply offended by everything happening around
Yeah,
him.
I was just thinking about that. Yeah. Well, he had his own ghost story in Wolf in the Fold. So maybe he'd be a little sympathetic. Absolutely. Yeah, you got to watch for those ghosties.
Like, I don't know. Archer probably just brings it into the decontamination room so everyone can have a go. Like, but I think that the one I enjoy imagining is Janeway having to deal with that, especially because if it's after she's had her own little holodeck Irishman thing, I feel like she has a lot of self-loathing, so she would hate it even more.
I'm so excited for Star Trek Prodigy to see her get to be like an actual mother figure to a group of kids.
Yeah, I'm excited for the actress too.
Yeah. Now that we reach the end of the show, and for your past appearances on the show, you'll receive a promotion to full lieutenant. And you, of course, are working in the command division in the negotiations department. And if you had to renegotiate the terms of a treaty with Planet Scotland, how well do you think that would go? What are they using Scots law there?
Oh, God. I hope they're not using 17th century Scots law. That is some grim.
They brought all the stones and they brought the law.
I know. We got to have a conversation about, like, are you guys happy? Like, deep down in your authentic heart.
Maybe they're stuck there. Yeah, maybe they take us with you.
Is this how you want it to be? Like, because, like, you did, your grandparents decided this. Do you want a city?
Yeah.
Like, it's not that hard to make
a
city.
A flying car?
How about Glasgow? You want a Glasgow? Like, Glasgow's pretty cool.
Right, yeah.
Like, you know, it doesn't have to be mud farming. So, genuinely, I just want to understand these people. And if they're happy, like LARPing sheep stealing scenarios with the pig aliens, which are never aliens. Really addressed. Like, the pig aliens are cool with playing Scotland games, I guess. I would really love to know how that happened. I would like to be a fly on the wall in that meeting where they're just like, okay, so we're all gonna wear kilts all the time and you should too. And the pig aliens are like, all right, fine. But no, I just want to talk about our choices.
Do you guys want a replicator that doesn't make just potato dishes here?
You know, there have been huge advances in the pudding field. Yes. No longer just black pudding and white pudding. Like, you can do anything.
So you've had space coal cannon. You've never lived. Well, Lieutenant Valenti, thanks for joining me to talk about Star Trek and the Star Trek universe.
Thank
and if
you.
People want to continue the conversation, and they can at EISTPod on Twitter and the Enterprising Individuals Facebook page, where can people find you online?
You can find me at Kat Valenti on Twitter and on Patreon by the same name.
Awesome. And your book, The Past is Red, comes out July 20th. Comfort Me with Apples on October 26th. And you are still in process on that space opera sequel.
Yep.
Soft date at all for that?
I think it'll probably end up being like spring 2023.
Sure. Can't rush greatness.
The last year was real distracting.
Well, yeah.
We had to wait for Eurovision to come back in 2021, and it was great. So let's hope it's the same.
And you just recently vague tweeted about Amazing News. Any update on that?
I can't say anything about it, and I definitely will not be able to say anything by the time this comes out. But I'm doing something cool and secret. And people will be very excited when they hear.
Well, that is good news itself, though. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you.
We're signing off until the next mission. Hailing Frequencies closed.
I'm Mikan Hana.
And I'm Caliban.
I'm a huge Sailor Moon fan. I've been a Moonie since the beginning. I've seen every episode, every movie. I've read all the manga. I love it.
I've got a head full of bad wiring, and I've never seen a single episode.
Do you want to join the wonderful world of Sailor Moon?
Okay. Enter laughing. It's hard to believe that was us. It feels like ancient history.
We recorded that a few minutes ago.
Ancient history, but now that I'm a Sailor Moon expert.
You're not an expert?
But I'm trying!
Every week on Sailor Noob, we talk about a new episode of the original Sailor Moon series.
It's all new to me.
And I'm a little more seasoned. I've been a Japanese language student, and I've lived in Japan.
And you use your experiences to talk about the food, fashion, and culture of every episode of Sailor Moon.
What do you do again?
Share in the wonder of a classic anime series.
Good enough. Sailor Noob is a great companion for first-time watchers, and it is a fun hit of nostalgia for the experienced fan.
You can catch the show every Friday wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr, posting all things Sailor Moon.
One day I shall be the master.
Let's just get through this series first.
Okay.